abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
And welcome, everybody, on this October 9th, 2013. Tom Woods here with Walter Block. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on opening banter. I want to get right to Walter. And some of the questions I'm going to be asking him come from my Facebook page. I solicited questions, and you guys rose to the occasion, gave me more than I could possibly use. So don't forget, make sure you're liking that Facebook page so that when I do solicit questions for the guests, you can jump in there and help me out. And unfortunately, I'm not on Facebook as Tom Woods. That would be too easy for you guys. I'm on as, Thomas E. Woods Jr., and unfortunately, there's nothing I can do about that. So the easiest way to like the page on Facebook is to go to tomwoodsradio.com and click the like button on the Facebook widget, and then you can be part of these discussions. What should we ask the guests? So that's coming up in just a minute. I did want to note to you a bit of good news. Here we are only in our third week, and we are already in the iTunes Top 100. An avid listener already has written to tell me this and sent me the screenshot and everything, which I then posted on Facebook, and I posted at tomwoods.com, my personal website. So we're at number 61, which is not too bad for only our third week of doing this, and considering how anti-establishment we are, and we're not naturally going to have 80 million listeners, so that's pretty darn good. So thank you guys for listening and for subscribing over there at iTunes. And then finally this week, don't forget, this week I am giving away copies of Rollback, my 2011 book, which somebody wrote to me and said, you know, I think this book really was meant to help me win debates, and that is exactly why I wrote it, is to help people win debates with their non-libertarian friends. It's sort of responding to all the government propaganda lines you've ever heard, why we need the Fed, or why the military-industrial complex is what makes America great, and don't we need the government to spend money on science research, and all, you know, a lot of the hard questions that you come up against, I tackle them in Rollback. So I'm giving those away to people just who sign up for libertyclassroom.com through October 11th, 2013. And then after that, I'm going to pretend I never made this offer. I don't know what you're talking about. You're a raving lunatic. I never offered a copy of Rollback. But signed and personalized, so head over to libertyclassroom.com, which is my website where you can learn the real history and economics that you should have gotten in school but probably didn't. You can learn it from me and from other people that you can trust. And then once you sign up, just send me a little note via the contact page there saying, hey, you bum Woods, I just signed up. Where's my book? And send me your address, and we'll get it right out to you. Okay, let's turn now to Walter Block. Walter is one of the great libertarian theorists today. He is a professor of economics at Loyola University, where he holds the Harold E. Worth Eminent Scholar Chair. He's written many thousands of articles and then hundreds of peer-reviewed scholarly articles. Now, if you have 25 to 50 scholarly articles published, that's considered to be a distinguished career. So Walter's got like 10 or 20 careers under his belt. It's quite astonishing. And of course, he's also well known for his quite shocking book, Defending the Undefendable, not to mention many other books. For example, he has a book, The Privatization of Roads and Highways. Every topic you'd think nobody would touch, Walter has been there many times over. So I'm very glad to welcome Walter Block. Walter Block, thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Always good to be with you, Tom.
Now, Walter, you are one of the people I think most frequently cited when people say, I became a libertarian because I heard X. Because what people like about you is not only that you seem to have an encyclopedic knowledge of all the sorts of issues that arise in libertarian circles, but also because you're just so forthright and to the point and in your face, yes, this is my answer, so be it. And that's precisely why I'm having you on here today, because that's what I want. I want the in-your-face answers to some of these hard questions. But let's start off with an easy one, because there are people who are coming to libertarianism all the time, and we can't assume everybody automatically knows the basics. So first of all, tell us, what is the non-aggression principle?
Tom, before I answer that, I'm a professor. I'm never allowed to answer anything directly. Let me just say that I can't believe that most people come to libertarianism because of me. Surely it's Ayn Rand or Murray Rothbard or Ron Paul or Ludwig von Mises or this guy named Tom Woods. But you're very nice to say that anyway.
Well, one of. How about that?
Okay, one of, I'll accept. What is the non-aggression axiom? It's just the normal sort of a thing that if you ask anyone, do they think that they have a right to initiate violence, you know, just haul off and punch some stranger in the nose or grab his wallet? Obviously, they would say no. So what the non-aggression axiom is, or the non-aggression principle, is keep your mitts to yourself. Don't grab other people without their permission. Don't grab their property without their permission. And that's all it is. And I think at that level, most people would say, yes, I agree with that. To not agree with that is to be barbaric. The problem comes when you try to deduce from that, or when you try to extrapolate from that, because we get into the question, well, suppose the government does something. Is that okay if they have a majority vote? But to just answer your question very succinctly, the non-aggression principle is keep your mitts to yourself, keep it off of other people and their property unless you get their permission.
So what are the political implications of this? It sounds all very, very convincing and commonsensical. And I, as you say, most people would say they agree with it. But what would they find shocking if it were actually implemented across the board?
They would find it shocking because it really vitiates against government taxation. Government says on April 15th, or now with withholding all through the year, you guys are going to pay us money. And we never agreed to pay them any money. So this is a very, very radical thing when applied to the government, because if you consistently and thoroughly extrapolate from the non-aggression principle, you have to oppose what government does, because government is doing things that we haven't agreed to. It's grabbing our property without our permission.
Well, some people may come back at you and say, yes, it's true that the government steals and government does all these things, but since we can't have civilization without government, then I guess civilization requires us to sometimes just give up our moral principles. We have to give up a little bit of the non-aggression principle in order to have sheer survival.
Well, this is an argument that is employed by some people, and what they would say is, yes, government is an evil, but it's a necessary evil, because if we didn't have it, we'd have chaos and what have you. And I would say that of all people who consider themselves libertarians, only about 5 or 10% are anarchist libertarians of the sort that I am, and would consistently, rigidly, maniacally deduce and extrapolate from this principle. Most people who are libertarians would be what I would call limited state libertarians, or minimal government advocates, or minarchists in the vernacular. For example, Ayn Rand was like that, and Ron Paul is a bit like that. And they would say, yes, so we have to have the non-aggression principle. However, we do need to make an exception for government, because without government, we'd have chaos. And the idea here is you have very limited government, armies, courts, police, armies to protect us from foreign bad guys, not to export democracy, police to protect us from local bad guys, not to uphold victimless crime laws, and courts to tell who's who. I would say that I am not a minimal government advocate, although I respect that position, and that's a perfectly coherent position, and I'd rather live under that society than our present one. But to get to your point, I think it's been demonstrated. There was this book, Uncle Sam, the Monopoly Man, where he demonstrates that each and every function that the government has ever performed has been performed by private enterprise more successfully. Armies, courts, police, roads, schools, healthcare, quality of medicine, Food and Drug Administration, things like that. You make a list of everything that's government has done, and most of it is bad, but even the good stuff that would exist in the market has been done successfully by non-government agencies. So I wouldn't accept that retort as definitive.
Now, I think most people, I don't know. Some people convert and become libertarians because they are convinced that the non-aggression principle is the right way to go. It makes moral sense. It corresponds to a moral intuition we all share. But I wonder, though, what's the light bulb aha moment that a lot of people have? I mean, in other words, not everybody is going to immediately hear that principle and say, yep, now I'm going to adapt all my views so that they're in conformity with the non-aggression principle. Is there something about libertarianism as a system or particular examples of libertarianism in action that you think are likely to grab people so that they're willing to consider the whole system?
Well, I think it's, you know, as an Austrian economist, I'm a methodological individualist, and I would say different strokes for different folks. Different people come to the one true faith, libertarianism, through different avenues, some through the deontology, namely the pure ethics of it, that it's improper, it's barbaric, it's uncivilized to initiate violence. And even if a majority says so, and this government is not really a club, taxes aren't really like club dues. So that's the deontological approach, and it affects some people. Other people are more utilitarian or consequentialist. They say, well, how would the courts work without the government? How could we certify the quality of food and drugs without the government? How could we have highways and streets and roads without the government? And that would be the consequentialist or utilitarian. And then there are third parties that get it half and half, half deontology, half utilitarian, and many other combinations and permutations of those. But I think those are the two, the pure ethic of it and the practicality of it.
Now, I want to jump to an economics question, just because, of course, you are an economics professor. You're not just a libertarian philosopher and theorist. And there's when I posted this on Facebook, and remember, guys, follow me on Facebook. Just go to TomWoodsRadio.com and click like in the Facebook widget, because I do put out requests for questions. And there's a good question that came up about the minimum wage, and I know you've written a lot about the minimum wage. And the questioner asks the following. He says, over the past 60 years, he sees no correlation between minimum wage hikes and hikes in unemployment. He says, now, sure, I understand there are lots of variables that can be offsetting. He says, but surely there should be some correlation. And moreover, I'm stymied by the fact that relatively high minimum wage countries often have low unemployment rates. Can you sort all this out, Walter Block?
Well, I can. I'll try. In a sense, this questioner is right, or this objector is correct. There probably isn't much of a correlation between a rise in the minimum wage, say the national minimum wage over the last 60 years or so, and unemployment. Other things cause unemployment beside the minimum wage, but even apart from that, the fact of the matter is that the minimum wage has been relatively stable in real terms over the past 60 years. Yes, it's gone from, what was it, 25 cents to 40 to 70 to $1.25 and 5.15, and I'm skipping a few, and now it's, 7.25, and they're thinking of raising it to 9. But in real terms, it hasn't changed that much. It's changed a little bit, but not that much. This would be what economists call a time series, namely you look at it over time. You can also do a cross-sectional analysis, namely at a point in time, various jurisdictions have various unemployment rates and also various minimum wage laws. I did a study like this in the 10 Canadian provinces a couple of years back, and I rated all the 10 Canadian provinces as to what their unemployment rate was for teenage workers or younger people compared to the overall unemployment rate. And I found a very, very strong correlation between high unemployment rate for unskilled workers, namely teenagers or young people, holding constant the overall unemployment rate and the minimum wage level. Other studies have been done for the various states, the 50 states, and they've also found these very strong correlations. And I think it's not exactly true to say that those countries that have no minimum wage or a very low minimum wage don't have a lot of unemployment. That's not true. But there is a correlation over countries as well. Namely, the higher the minimum wage you have, other things equal, the more unemployment you'll get. And that other things equal is crucially important because, as I say, other things create unemployment beside the minimum wage, but the minimum wage does create unemployment. Another point that I would make in this regard is the overall unemployment rate that the government tells us is 7%. The real one, shadow statistics, is more like 15%. But the unemployment rate for black male teenagers that even the government admits is something like 40 or 50%, which is stupendously high. And you could just see the minimum wage law working there. Well, so much for statistics. Now let's just look at the logic. The minimum wage law is not an employment law. It never guarantees anyone a job. It just says if you're hired, then you have to be paid $7.25. But suppose your productivity is only $5 an hour. If they hire you at $7.25, they'll lose $2.25 on the deal, so they're not likely to hire you, and if they do, they're likely to go bankrupt. So the point is that the minimum wage law is not like a floor under wages that raises wages. Rather, it's a barrier, and you have to have a productivity of $7.25 an hour, otherwise you don't get a job. That's why the unemployment rate is so high for unskilled workers.
All right, now that we've covered an economic topic, I want to jump back into the sort of traditional puzzles, let's say, that come up with libertarianism. And I feel sorry even bringing this up. If it weren't for the fact that you had written a book on this subject, I would really feel guilty raising this subject. But everybody always jokes that the question they get is, what about the, fill in the blank, Walter, what about the
roads?
The roads. Okay, so you wrote a book on the privatization of roads and highways. So give us the zippy sort of answer to this.
Well, the zippy sort of answer is, do you know how many people die on our wonderful socialist roads? It's something like 40,000 a year over the last 10 years. It might be a little lower, 38, 39,000, but that's an awful lot of people. To put this in context, I mean, how many people were killed in 9/11? Just 3,000. How many people were killed in the aftermath of Katrina, which was not due to Katrina, but to the Army Corps of Engineers and FEMA? Only about 1,900 people. And, you know, every once in a while you have a mass shooting like in Connecticut or Aurora, Colorado, or in the Navy Yard or whatever, and you get a dozen people killed. Now, look, I'm not trying to deprecate those number of people killed. Every life is precious. But here it's 40,000. That's a lot of zeros. And Obama's not talking about it. Bush never talked about it. No one talks about this. It's sort of like, death and taxes, you know, it's inevitable. But no, I don't think it's inevitable. I think it's due to the fact that we have a Sovietized, one rule fits all kind of monopoly highway system run by government, whether it's federal or state doesn't matter much. My idea that I make in this book on privatizing the roads is let us have some competition. Let us have the Tom Woods Highway and the Walter Block Highway, and let's say they run parallel to each other, and the Tom Woods Highway is a great highway and very few people die, and the Walter Block Highway is a charnel house. People are being killed like flies. And the Tom Woods Highway is going to take my customers away, or I will start emulating the Tom Woods Highway, and I will come up with better, more competitive ways of running the highway, which would reduce deaths. What kinds of things could we implement? What could the Tom Woods Highway do that the Walter Block Highway isn't doing? Just to give you an example of how road managers could compete with each other to reduce deaths. Well, they say speed kills. But maybe it doesn't. Maybe it's not speed. Maybe it's the variance in speed. The way the government highway has it, it's a minimum of 40 miles an hour and a maximum of 70. But if you go on one of our major highways at 70, a lot of people are going to pass you. Most people do 73, 75, 76, and they don't get tickets for that. Whereas every once in a while you get some, person doing 50 or 55. Namely, there's a very big variance in speed. Maybe a better way to do it, if you have a three-lane highway going in one direction, instead of everyone has to go between 40 and 70, or actually between 40 and 75, or even up to 80, maybe a much better way to do it is the left lane, everybody has to do 80. The middle lane, everyone has to do 70. And the right lane, everyone has to do 60. I don't know. I'm not a road manager, but I'm a speculator on this. I'm speculating that maybe that would reduce deaths. And another speculation is when one truck is about to pass another and you know it's going to take them 15 minutes or 15 miles to pass it, people hit the gas and try to get ahead of that truck before it passes the truck. Maybe we should make a rule that, the truck on the right should let the other guy go by quickly so that he doesn't hog up the road. Another possibility is, you know, it's legal to do 65 miles an hour in the left lane. And a lot of people want to do 70, 75, 80. Maybe we should give tickets for people who do who sit in the left lane and go very slowly, because people who want to go faster have to nip in and out of the lane. So here are three things. And in my book, I must mention, oh, I don't know, 20 or 30 or 40 of these things, that if different roads had different rules of the road or different techniques, maybe we would find out which ones did better. Maybe we would have laboratories in finding out how we could reduce deaths. But no. What we have is a monopoly, one rule or one style of management fits all. And we never learn how to reduce deaths. It's as if these rules of the road come from Washington, D.C., as on stone tablets.
But I think the concern people have is that road building would not be profitable for a private firm. So how do you answer that?
Well, I don't see why road building wouldn't be profitable. I mean, there are many objections. One, you'd have to have eminent domain to get roads built in the first place. Another, it wouldn't be profitable. I don't see why it wouldn't be profitable. I mean, you would charge a fee. Now, you wouldn't have to stop at every 3 feet and put a penny in the meter the way they do on roads and on tunnels and bridges. What you would do is... you would have some sort of universal product code like they now have on everything in a grocery store or in a pharmacy store. And when you go to the grocery store and, you know, you buy a can of Coke, they flip it over the glass and it goes blip. Well, you would have something on the underbody of your car, and it would indicate that you went on the Tom Woods Road for 10 miles. And at the end of the month, you'd get a bill for that, or you'd put in money at the beginning of the month so that it would come out of your account. These techniques I discuss in the book. So it would be like any other service. I mean, to say that roads wouldn't be profitable is to say no one wants to use roads, and that's silly. Look, railroads are profitable, or at least when not run by government, they're profitable. Roads and railroads are long, thin things. I don't see why one would be profitable and the other not. So I would reject that objection.
Now, I think also what you're describing could well be the case, that there would be two roads that sort of directly compete with one another, but it might not have to be that. It could also work in a way where I'm a merchant, I'm a big store, and I want people to come to my store. So one of the ways I'm going to do that is as a public service, I'll offer roads, I will beautify the roads, I'll make the trip from their house to my store as pleasant and delightful as possible and as safe as possible. And along the way, they'll probably see discounts they can get at my store. And so therefore, they can drive on the roads for free the same way most people watch before cable TV. They watch TV for free. It gets paid for through other ways. So in other words, if there's a Sears store and then an apartment complex somewhere, I don't think all the parties involved would just be saying they're scratching their heads. Well, gee, what do we do now? Sears would have an interest in making sure people have some way to get there, right?
Absolutely. And we do even have private roads right now. You go to a Walmart or a Sears, and there's this gigantic parking lot of acres and acres and acres, and you just can't park anywhere. You have to park where the parking spaces are. But in between the parking spaces are private roads. And Sears or Walmart or any large department store has an incentive to make those private roads run efficiently, and they'll put plants there or they'll put trees there. They'll make it as safe as they can. But they're still under the aegis of the government. They have to have parking for handicapped people. Although it's interesting that some of the new initiative in this regard is special parking spots for pregnant women. Yeah. And this was not initiated by government. This was initiated by private people in their parking lots. So you're quite right. It need not be that you're going to have to pay for all roads. They could be like lost leaders. Look, when you go into Walmart again or to a supermarket, you don't pay for the lights. You don't pay for the cleanliness of the aisles. Rather, you just pay for what you buy. They give you that as a lost leader in order to attract you into the place. You don't pay for the air conditioning either. I live in the South, as you do, Tom, or did, and we appreciate the air conditioning, but you don't pay for it directly. So I think you're making a very good point that I do discuss in my book, that you need not have to pay for this, but it could be given to you for free and on a profit-making basis.
Now, Walter, I want to ask a couple things that come up a lot, again, in libertarian discussions. And again, these are areas, I was about to say, I was thinking to myself, isn't it an interesting coincidence that the things I want to talk about happen to be things Walter has written about? But that's because Walter's written about everything. So that's, it's not just a funny coincidence that it comes out this way. But I know you had a co-authored article on the subject of corporations. And that comes up a lot because we get some libertarians who say corporations are an example of government privilege. They enjoy special government privileges. And I used to hold that view because then that was a way that I could show to the left how cool I was, that, hey, I don't like corporations either because they're getting special privileges from the government. But I don't believe that anymore, and I don't think that's your opinion either. So what do you say to somebody who says the corporation in getting a charter from the government is being given a special privilege and therefore is not a market institution?
Well, first, let me firm up both of our left-wing credentials. We Pinkos, we believe that some corporations do get special government privileges and bailouts and subsidies, and that's really crony capitalism or corporate state monopoly capitalism or economic fascism, and obviously we would oppose that. But the question you're asking is not, do some corporations get special privileges? Lord knows they do. But rather, is the corporate structure per se a grant of privilege? And here I would agree with you that it is not. Namely, without any special privilege with regard to a commercial interaction, I could make a contract with you. One contract with you is the non-corporate contract, and if somehow I fail to fulfill my end of the deal, you can sue me not only for the value of my private company, but also sue me for my house or my car or my bicycle or whatever. That's one way, and that's the way that some of our left-wing friends think it ought to be. But another way is, I say, look, Tom, I want to make a special deal with you. If I renege or if I don't fulfill my contract, you can sue me, but only up to the value of the company that I'm putting together. Say, only up to $1 million. You can't come after my house, my car, my bicycle, my violin, whatever it is. And if you agree with that, that's no special privilege, just a matter of contract. And I don't see why that would be a per se violation of rights, that you agree not to sue me for everything, but have a limited liability corporation. Namely, my liability only goes up to the $1 million that I got into this company or corporation. I don't see why that is a per se violation of rights.
So in other words, what would happen is that people who would lend to an institution like this would know ahead of time that they can't go after, you know, the shareholders' kids' college fund, for example.
Right.
They would know. And so therefore, they would probably, let's say in a completely free market, they would lend to them maybe at a slight premium to compensate them for the fact that, okay, that we know there's a limited amount that we can go after in case of default or whatever.
Precisely. That is exactly the case. You might have to pay a higher premium, a higher interest rate, or you might charge me a little bit more if we're dealing in a non-bank situation. But that's just part of the market. And there are certain advantages of the corporate format, namely that you can amalgamate large amounts of money from many different stockholders. Mises even went so far as to say that one of the key distinctions between a free society and a non-free society is a stock market. Well, it's hard to have a stock market without corporations.
All right. I want to hit on at least one more thing before I let you go, because, of course, we could have a whole program on environmentalism, which, you know, we couldn't get to, or if land is taken from the natives, do they have a right to get it back 500 years later? I mean, there are all kinds of things to talk about. But I did get a question from somebody on the subject of insider trading, which comes up in the news once in a while. What would be the libertarian view of insider trading? And after explaining what it is, how can you explain it in a way that will sound reasonable to the average person?
Well, let me take a hack at that. That's a good question. Look, Tom, suppose you and I want to go into business, and I've got a lot of money, and you are a helicopter driver or a helicopter pilot, and we're looking for, I don't know what, oil or gold or some valuable thing. And I can make two kinds of deals with you. One, I can say, look, Tom, I'm going to pay you a nice salary, oh, $250,000 a year, which is a very nice salary. And if you find any gold or jewelry or anything out there, you have to tell me, and you can't. You have to promise that you can't use it on your own account. You can't start buying up land around there, but you're my employee. that's one contract, and that's certainly a valid contract. But I'm thinking maybe I'll offer you a different contract. I'll say, look, Tom, I can't really afford to pay you $250,000 as a salary, but I want you to go prospecting, whether with a truck or a helicopter, it doesn't matter. And if you find on your own account, namely this inside information that you've just got from me, you can use it too, but I'll pay you a lower salary. Now, is that a valid contract? I don't see why not. It's very similar to the corporate structure as well. So both contracts are legitimate. Neither one violates the non-aggression axiom or the non-aggression principle of libertarianism. And yet one is perfectly legal and the other is horrendous. The other, if we did the other, we could both go to jail. And I don't see how you should be going to jail for that, because as a libertarian, the only reason that you should be punished is if you violate the libertarian non-aggression principle. And this second contract, where you can now avail yourself of inside information, is perfectly reasonable. Now, if somebody else breaks into my desk and steals the inside information, well, then they're a criminal, but not because they're using inside information, but because they trespassed.
But how would you then respond to somebody who says, this just goes to show that just as I suspected, libertarianism is all about protecting the fat cats, protecting the people on the inside. Now you even want to protect people who are going to prosper on the basis of inside information. What chance does a little guy have in the libertarian world?
Well, that's true. We do hate the little guy. No, I shouldn't say that. I'm just kidding. We don't hate the little guy. Mises and other of our leaders, our forebears, our intellectual godfathers have said that capitalism really helps the little guy very, very much. The example I sometimes use is in the good old days, the king had a coach and horses, a coach and six horses, and the poor guy had a walk. Nowadays, the fat cat has got a Cadillac or a Maserati, and the little guy's got a Ford Focus. Now, who's improved more? When you go from a coach and six to a Maserati, that's a big improvement, but surely it's a much bigger improvement when you go from walking to a Ford Focus. Or take another example. The king had a lot of candles, or the fat cat in the 16th century had a chandelier with 100 candles, and he was well lit. And the poor guy, when it got dark, that was it. He had to go to sleep because he had no candles, no light at all. Well, nowadays, the rich guy's got chandeliers that could cost $250,000, and the little guy's got a little light bulb, and he can keep it on all night. Who has benefited more? Similarly with TV, the poor guy has got TV shows, and the rich guy used to have special ballet people coming in for him, and the poor guy had no entertainment. Now the poor guy has got very good entertainment. So in all these cases, both rich and poor gain from capitalism and from economic progress, but the poor gains much, much more. The poor woman has nylon stockings. In the old days, the rich woman had silk stockings and the poor woman had no stockings, and now they both have nylon stockings, so there's not really that much difference. So in many, many ways, it's the poor who gain more from capitalism. Look, where would you rather be? Poor in a relatively free marketplace, or middle class in some of these very poor nations where you have very little economic freedom? I used to watch the Olympics in the 80s, and whenever they would interview a Russian gold medal winner, they would always interview him in a little apartment, not outside, in an apartment, and then outside he'd have a little red car. And I always wondered, why was this? And the answer was that in the Soviet Union, the only young person who could get an apartment of his own and a little red car was a guy who won a gold medal in the quarter mile or whatever the Olympic event was. Whereas in the U.S., which is a relatively freer country, although it keeps reducing its freedom, you can work in McDonald's and have a little red car, maybe not a new one, but a usable car. You can have a color TV, you can have air conditioning. So it's crazy to think that libertarians like favor the fat cats. When I started this answer, I said that we do oppose bailouts, corporate subsidies and bailouts and stuff like that, what they did in Detroit and what they did in Wall Street. We libertarians do not favor crony capitalism. We favor laissez-faire capitalism, which is a very very different kettle of fish.
Well, Walter, we are out of time, but I'm very grateful to have had Walter Block here with us. So thanks so much for taking so much time with us, and I hope everybody will come visit walterblock.com to get a sense of, as I indicated in the introduction, just how much work you've done and are still doing. How many scholarly articles do you have pending right now?
Well, I don't know about pending, but pending plus published, I'm up to about 450.
Wow. Okay. Well, Walter, again, I much appreciate your time, and thanks so much for being here.
Always a pleasure, Tom. Anything.
All right, that's it for the show for today, everybody. But a couple quick programming notes. This Friday, October 11th, we're going to be joined by Eric Voorhees, who's going to talk to us about the future of Bitcoin in the wake of Silk Road. So I really could use some questions from you guys. Tweet me some questions over at Thomas E. Woods. Thomas E. Woods is where you can tweet me those questions. Whatever you want to know, no holds barred here. Let's ask some tough questions, get some interesting answers. That's coming up on Friday, so the sooner you can get me those questions, the better. And don't forget also the thing that's sapping the life out of me, RonPaulHomeschool.com. I'm creating courses for that. It's 180 videos per course, and I'm doing so far 3.5 courses. Do the math there. It's pretty devastating, but very, very important work, I think. Probably the most important work I've ever done. So I hope you'll check that out. And don't forget also the book giveaway this week only, signed and personalized copy of Rollback, your guide for winning debates, in effect, with your non-libertarian friends. So sign up for libertyclassroom.com and get that. And that's it, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for tuning in.
The Tom Woods Show.